Support for WPR comes from Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. Academic scholarships are automatically offered to eligible students upon admission, and all Luther students receive some form of financial aid. Luther.edu.
Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today as we take a look at a piece of the Civil War. You know, the Civil War is it's a rich and well-documented period in our country's history, and today we're going to take a couple of different looks at it. I'm glad you could join us today on the Ideas Network. Our first guest today is award-winning and best-selling author Jeff Shara. His works of historical fiction put you and I inside the events that have shaped our world by telling the stories of people living through the experience firsthand. His most recent book, The Smoke at Dawn, is part of a series of Civil War novels, focuses on the summer and fall of 1863. It was a pivotal point in the conflict and was vital to the efforts on the Western Front of the conflict. You can join in with your questions today at 1-800-642-1234. Have you read Jeff's books? Do you enjoy historical fiction? Certainly hope you do. And he joins us today. It was so great. Jeff, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it.
No, it's my pleasure. Happy to be here.
Well, it's great. We've talked a few times over the years about several of your books, actually. This one, again, a real page-turner, even when you know the outcome.
I love that. Thank you.
you obviously know how things turn out, and we all do, but does that make it difficult to write for characters who don't have the knowledge that you do?
Well, actually, no. People ask me a lot, actually other writers will ask me if I work from an outline. And what I tell them is no, because the history is the outline. I mean, what happened, the events. I mean, one of the things novelists often will do is change history. I mean, they can, you know, they're writing fiction. They can do anything they want. And I'm very much the opposite of that. I'm painstaking in getting it right. But that being said, I mean, the characters at the time, the voices of this story, who are people, in many cases, people you know, historical figures, they don't know how it's going to turn out. And there are no foregone conclusions. And, I mean, this was true all the way back with George Washington. It was true with Dwight Eisenhower during the Normandy invasion. I mean, all the way through the stories I try to tell, my job is to take you with me and put you back there. And put you in the heads and in the rooms with these characters and on the field with these characters, they have no idea how the history is going to end. And that's, if I do my job, then you end up feeling the same way.
And it's got to be, the amount of research that you do has got to be enormous.
The research is the largest part of it, and that's something else I'm asked a lot about, the nature of the research. In every case, the voices of the people who were there, whether it's diaries, memoirs, collections of letters, some written memoirs, some are recorded sort of haphazardly, and you can find them in papers in places like West Point and so forth. But that's essential, because someone actually said to me, how dare you put words in the mouth of Robert E. Lee? Well, okay, challenge accepted. I mean, if I dare to put words in the mouth of Lee or Grant, or I mentioned, you know, Washington, Ben Franklin, or, you know, right on up, I had better be sure that those words are authentic to the character, because if they're not, and if they're counterfeit, you will know that immediately. I mean, the reader and the book just doesn't work. So, yes, that is the biggest part, is hearing. I don't like to sound schizophrenic about it, but I describe it as hearing the voices. I mean, hearing the voices of these characters so that I'm comfortable speaking for them.
And in some cases, you can almost do verbatim from their own remembrances.
Well, sometimes that's exactly the case. I mean, we do. For example, Ulysses Grant's memoir, which is a marvelous. I mean, who knew that Grant would write what I believe is the finest memoir written by a U.S. president. And I mean, so sometimes there are passages, or there are where, you know, explanations where he's talking to some particular other character where I can quote verbatim, and that's what's really nice about that. And that goes up to, I mean, Winston Churchill. I mean, some marvelous characters who wrote extensively on their own experiences. that's gold to me because I can draw on that. But then, of course, my job is to fill in the blanks around that.
And you do that very well. And I'll mention that I've read many, many books on the Civil War. And one of the things that I really enjoy about your books is the fact that they are so true to the events as they occurred.
Well,
and then have the value of sort of the conversation part of it really brings it to life.
Well, thank you. And one of the things I began to hear a few years ago when I started this from teachers who were using these books, you know, particularly sort of high school age teachers, using these books in their classroom, and that immediately added to the responsibility I felt, okay, you better get it right. You know, so when you're having, you know, the conversations are one thing, but where are these people? In other words, I never put people together who never actually met. I never put somebody in a place he never was, or create a situation that simply didn't happen, because then, again, the credibility suffers. Now, you know, a novel and credibility, that's sort of, you know, they're sort of separate terms, but I try to bridge that gap. I really do.
And I think, you know, you and I have talked about this before on the show, but for new listeners and people who haven't heard you speak, how did talk about how you actually got started doing this work? It's really interesting.
I had an enormous door opened to me for me by my father. Michael Shara wrote The Killer Angels, which is a book many people are familiar with. It's the story of the Battle of Gettysburg. The movie Gettysburg is based on that book, Ted Turner's film. The book came out 40 years ago, 1974, won the Pulitzer Prize in 75. When the movie came out in 1993, it made the book a number one bestseller 5 years after my father's death. He had no idea what he left behind. And he wasn't around to write the prequel and the sequel. Turner got very excited that the film was very successful. They came to me. Now, I had never written anything before, but the idea was to go before and after Gettysburg with many of the same characters to tell the same kind of a story that my father told in The Killer Angels. And I was a little bit terrified by that, but the idea was, I'll put a story together, someone else will adapt for a screenplay. It was always about being a film, so I had no fear, because we actually talked about, the more I got into this, okay, if the story stinks, if whatever you come up with is no good, it goes in the trash and nobody will ever see it, so don't worry about it. Just put a story together. Well, the story was Gods and Generals, which, I'm dealing with Random House in New York as my father's sort of the agent for my father's estate. Random House reads the manuscript and says, we like this, we don't care if it's a movie, here's a contract. Well, I mean, that was a stunning surprise to me and changed my whole life. And now, 14 books later, here I am. But, I mean, that door clearly was opened for me by my father, by his early death. He was only 59 when he died of heart disease. And, I had no expectations that I would be here now, speaking to you about this.
Well, and Gods and Generals is a wonderful book. I can see why Random House wanted that book. It's you did a marvelous job with it.
Well, thank you.
We have callers online, by the way. I should mention Jeff Shara, our guest today, talking with him about his writing and about his latest book. It's called The Smoke at Dawn. And another of his in his Civil War series of books, and I'm really enjoying having him with us. I hope you are too. You can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Have you read Jeff's books? Or do you have some questions about his work? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'd certainly love to hear from you. And let's go to Ben in Madison. Ben, hi. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you, Larry. I just wanted to thank both his father and him for doing such a great job. And I was a really fan of his father's work, Killing Angels. And I wondered how you went about doing your research in terms of the historical parts of your books. I read Revolutionary War, the books on Revolutionary War, and the American Revolution, that I think was a total miracle. And but I just wonder how much you rely on the on personal interviews with historians. And mm-hmm. I'm just reading right now Ellis's book on American creation, and how much you also rely on the historical text and where you go to do that. And
Sure. Well, I can tell you, first of all, I have an enormous luxury that my father did not have, and that's the Internet. And I can remember that. I mean, I learned about the kind of research to use from him. I mean, I watched him as a kid, and he would, you know, have a book sent in. It might take him 3 months to track down, and he'd find it in some obscure library. Now with the Internet, I can search these sources, and within a week with a credit card, I mean, I have a library. And I mean, that's a huge luxury and a huge time saver for me. It took him 7 years to write The Killer Angels. I don't have that kind of time in between books. So, I mean, I make enormous use of the Internet to search the books. You mentioned historians, and one thing I don't do is I don't read modern historical books or biographies. That does me no good at all. And biographers will argue this with you, and they argue it with me. But when you're reading a biography, say, for example, of Grant or Lincoln or Lee or whoever it might be, you're getting the biographer's take on that character. Now, they will tell you, oh, no, we get it right, we do the facts. Well, okay, fine, but there are, you know, 1,000 biographies of Abraham Lincoln. Every one of them is different.
Yeah.
So that, you know, knowing that, I mean, I stay away from that, and I go back wherever possible to the original sources. And if the character himself did not write a memoir, as, for example, Robert E. Lee never wrote a memoir, George Washington never wrote a memoir, but the people around them did. And so you can get the firsthand accounts, even if you don't have the actual voices of the character. And, I mean, that is a, as I said before, that is a big part, the largest part of what it takes, really, to put these books together.
Yeah, yeah.
Can I ask a follow-up question?
Sure.
Yeah, we're here in Wisconsin, and, you know, I've read a lot about the Wisconsin Brigades. And do you know, has anybody written about, you know, because there was such a lot of different ethnic groups that came, the Germans and all the others.
Yes, there are. In every state, particularly in the Union, more so in the Union than in the Confederacy, there are regimental histories, and you can actually search for those online. I mean, I think the 18th Wisconsin, the 24th Wisconsin, I mean, these are, you know, regiments that were active in, particularly in the West, where I'm researching right now, the 16th, certainly. Yes, I mean, these regimental histories are out there, not complete. I mean, not you can't go from like 1 to 30 or so forth and find them, but there are some. And you know, every now and then a regiment would have a guy who felt like, you know, we need to do this. We need to record this. And so they did. And so, no, you can search that online, and you would be surprised how much material, particularly about Civil War, how much material is out there now.
It's kind of amazing to me in some ways, although here I am, somebody who's really interested in the Civil War. 150 years after it happened, it's still very much on people's minds.
Oh, definitely. Well, you know, there are many things about the Civil War that are unique. One of them, it's our war. I mean, nobody else was involved. I mean, as much as the Confederacy wanted the English to get involved, I mean, the cliche of brother against brother is sort of become sort of Hollywoodized a little bit. That's a shame, because it's an accurate cliche. I live right now in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. There were Southern soldiers from this part of the country, you know, who were working, laboring in the South, got caught up in it and ended up joining the Confederate Army. They come to Gettysburg. I mean, they come back to their hometown. I mean, there's a tremendous sadness to that. And beyond the fact that it's also by far the bloodiest war we've ever fought, there are more casualties, more killed during the Civil War than in all other American wars combined.
Yeah.
And then you add in the cultural part of it. And I'm from New Jersey. I grew up in Tallahassee, Florida, so I'm right smack on the fence. But I heard it on both sides. And, I mean, the animosity towards, you know, Yankees in the South is palpable. I mean, I as a first grader, I heard that, kids calling me a Yankee. I didn't know what that was. It is, you know, 150 years later, there still is a lack of, you know, complete peace with that. And you know, there are many reasons for that, but certainly ancestry. I mean, I meet people all the time whose great-great-grandfather was in the war, and they might have some of his artifacts, some, you know, his uniform, his sword. It is our war, and there's enormous emotion to that. I respect that a great deal.
Yeah. Jeff Scherer, our guest today, author of many, many books, including the one we're talking about today, The Smoke at Dawn. This is the third in a four-part, I guess you'd call it, series of books he's writing relating to the Civil War. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great having you with us here on the Ideas Network. I hope you'll stay tuned because coming up at noon today, we're going to visit with two Wisconsin Civil War reenactors and find out how they research and plan their events. Right now, though, we're talking with award-winning novelist Jeff Scherer about his most recent Civil War book. It's titled The Smoke at Dawn. Questions for him? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on my Facebook page. Just go to The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And we have Matt in Brookfield up next with a question for you, Jeff. Hi, Matt. Thanks for calling.
You're welcome. Good morning.
Morning.
Jeff, I was wondering, it seems like it must be pretty challenging to try to write a sort of moving and authentic sort of emotional internal dynamics when you don't really have the choice of what decisions people make or even what they say. Is that something that is can be difficult for you, or is it just sort of a challenge you enjoy? Or
well, part again with the research, I mean, we know what happened. I mean, we know that when certain decisions were made, we know the outcome. There are a lot of examples of decisions that were, you know, that were poorly made, that resulted in the way the war actually turned out, or, you know, pieces of the war, turned out, bad decisions by bad commanders. And that's a big part of the story, almost in every case. But I mean, again, by understanding the characters themselves, what kind of personalities these people had, and boy, there's some beauts. I mean,
yeah.
Like Braxton Bragg or even, you know, Sherman, and, you know, exploring. I mean, these are three-dimensional human beings. These are not just names in a history book. They're not just statues on a battlefield. And that's part of the fun for me, is feeling like I'm comfortable, you know, as though all I'm doing is I'm sitting in the room with these people and I'm describing to you what I see and what I hear. That's when the research gets to that point where I'm that comfortable with the characters, then I know it's time to sit down and start writing. And I never write anything until I get to that point. And I don't know how that happens. I don't claim to be the best at that or anything like that. And I hate to use the word magic, but that's part of, to me, that's what it feels like. It's the magic of writing when, after I've done so much research, because frankly, if you wanted to read research on Civil War characters, you could be reading for the next 100 years and not cover it all.
Sure.
There has to be a point when, okay, enough is enough. But when that point happens, it's a wonderful thing. And I'm rarely uncomfortable putting, you know, describing what you're saying about, you know, making a decision, or, you know, because, again, we know what happened. Okay, how was that decision arrived at? And then to consider from the character's point of view, that they might make the wrong decision, and sometimes they did. And that's the key. This is not all John Wayne and the guys in the black hats, where every decision John Wayne makes is the right one. No, it's not like that at all. And that's what makes them human.
Thanks, Matt, for calling. I really appreciate your call. And Brian in Milwaukee will give you a chance now. Hi, Brian. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you. I was just wondering what Mr. Scherer would recommend, what battlefield he would recommend visiting the most, other than Gettysburg, which seems like the obvious one.
Yeah, Gettysburg clearly is at the top of the heap. I mean, that is the in terms of preservation, in terms of the person who knows nothing about Civil War can go to Gettysburg and really get something out of it. And that's really the criteria that I use. And I wrote a book. I wrote the only nonfiction book I've done is a Jeff Scherer Civil War Battlefields, and I'm not touting that book, but I'm answering your question this way. I picked the 10 sites And I based them, and I chose them based on the state of preservation. In other words, if you go to a place where there's strip malls everywhere, you're not going to get a lot out of that, no matter how historically important the battle is. But there are places, and I can give you the short list of the 10. Shiloh is in south central Tennessee. It is a magnificent place to visit. Vicksburg, when you can stand on the town, the bluffs above the Mississippi River looking down, it's absolutely beautiful. You can see why that town was a fortress. Antietam, certainly, and Fredericksburg, Chancellorsville, again, for historical importance. But, you know, these are places that what I describe in the Battlefields book, I aim the choices at the backseat people. You know, you see a car with a family on a battlefield. The front seat people are, you know, they're reading every monument. They're looking at the cannons. The people in the back seat are going, oh, you know, can we go back to the hotel now? Those are the people I wanted to aim at, is to give them a list. And, you know, and again, I've given you a short list. I mean, there are a few. I mean, there are Chickamauga, Spotsylvania, Newmarket in the Shenandoah Valley. They just had their 150th anniversary there. And I mean, these are poignant places. This is our hallowed ground. And I mean, I strongly recommend that people get out. Gettysburg, certainly. If there was one place you were going to pick, that's the place to go.
And I visited Antietam and Gettysburg. And one thing I would just add to that, and you probably are going to agree with me, the parks people, for example, at Gettysburg, every day we were there, we went on different tours with the parks people who really know their stuff. And there were different pieces of the battle. You can walk with someone who is really skilled and has read a lot about it and knows a lot about it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and if you consider just the briefest of history lessons about Gettysburg, here's a battle that covers 3 days, and there are over 170,000 participants. Gettysburg is 36 square miles. There's a lot to see, and you're not going to do it in an hour and a half.
No.
And so, I mean, I tell people, if you're coming here, yeah, get a guide. You know, and with all due respect to the bus, you know, tour people, I mean, that's okay. That's nice. You're in air conditioning. You're not going to see the battlefield from a bus. You really need to get a guide, go around in your own car, get out and walk. Horseback tours. That's another thing for people who like riding horses. They're marvelous tours. But it is, when you walk the ground, which is a big part, another part of my research, which I didn't really mention before, getting out and walking the footsteps of these people. You can really, I mean, when you see it, when you see what it must have been like to walk across this piece of open ground, and over there is a guy with a rifle or musket shooting at you, what was that like? Well, walking the ground, you really can get a sense of that. I strongly recommend people do that.
Yeah, I can remember, it's been a few years now, but I can remember walking across the ground, Pickett's charge.
Yes, I've done the same thing. I did it with my father, actually, when I was 12 years old. You know, the other thing, and I'll just mention this quickly, what's happening at Gettysburg and also at Vicksburg is the Park Service is going in and removing trees where there were no trees. So in 1863, if there was open ground, it's now open ground again. And if there were trees, like a peach orchard or an apple orchard, they're planting those trees. So they're restoring the ground to what it looked like at the time of the battle. That's a huge improvement.
Oh, yes.
You get even more out of the experience.
That is absolutely true. Well, Brian, thank you so much for calling. I appreciate
your
call.
Thank you very much. Very helpful.
Yeah, thank you. Jim in Menominee Falls, it's your turn. Hi, Jim.
Good morning.
Morning.
I wanted to just make a comment. I heard an earlier caller mention your father, and I thought, you know, I'm going to call this young man or Mr. Shara and complain about his father. years ago, how many years you mentioned? 20 some years ago, I suppose, that he wrote that book, Killer Angels.
Well, 40 actually.
40.
So,
mm-hmm.
All right. Well, I told the answer 30. So okay, 40 years ago, I read that book, and I went off the deep end on the Civil War. I mean, seriously, I have redesigned my house because of the books. I have 3 Civil War guns. I've been to every battlefield you've mentioned. And all because of that silly book. And I've got nephews now that say, Uncle Jim, what do you think I should read if about the Civil War? I said, well, stay away from that book. Because you will never move on to the First World War, the Second World War, Vietnam. You will be stuck like I was. And one last comment. I have two. You can't have too many. If you can have two, why not? Two copies of Grant's memoir. Mm-hmm. And we have an excellent, I believe it's called Renaissance Books, at the airport in Milwaukee. And I walked in there one day, and they won't take anything but cash. So like all the money I had on me for my trip, I ended up buying another set of those books. So all I'm saying is it's all your father's fault, and it's too bad he's no longer with us and can hear this.
Well, I appreciate that, and I also appreciate the spirit in which you're, you know, communicating that. Yeah. Thank you. I hear from a lot of spouses of people who say it's your fault. You know, my husband or my, you know, will never come to bed, or he brings a book to bed with him. And I mean, that's a very nice compliment. I will say this: I can't tell you how many people have said to me, "I hated history in school. Last thing in the world I wanted to do was to pick up a history book. Someone handed me a copy of The Killer Angels or one of your books, and it's like, oh, I don't want to read a book about the Civil War. I reluctantly read it. Now I'm bringing my kids to Gettysburg." And I meet a lot of those people. I mean, that's a compliment to my father's work. It's certainly a compliment to mine that I take very seriously. But it's a compliment to his work he never heard. And he never got much of that. And, I mean, I take that very seriously as well. I'm very aware that I'm walking in enormous footsteps.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. We haven't talked about your book yet. It's I wish we really should. It's the third in your four-part series. You had The Blaze of Glory and A Chain of Thunder. This book is The Smoke at Dawn. First, maybe just in general, how did you arrive at this series?
Well, first of all, I can't tell you when I was working on, a long time ago, working on Gods and Generals and The Last Full Measure, sort of finishing a trilogy around my father's book, I started to hear from an awful lot of people in Mississippi and Tennessee who said, you know what, we're kind of tired of hearing about Robert E. Lee in Virginia. I mean, there's a whole lot of stuff that happens west of the Appalachian Mountains that nobody ever talks about. And they're absolutely right. And I started looking into that a little more and finding, again, my job is not to give you a history lesson. I don't write history books. My job is to find characters to tell the story of that history through the eyes of really interesting characters. And boy, I found some. And I'd intended to do a trilogy because publishers like trilogies. Mm-hmm. And I'm not really sure why.
Yeah.
They can put them in a box, I guess. So we had always talked about doing a trilogy. Well, the first two were easy. Shiloh is the first, is A Blaze of Glory, April of 1862. It is a tremendous story. Some of the characters, I mean, Sherman and Grant on the northern side. You've got Albert Sidney Johnston, Nathan Bedford Forrest, Beauregard. I mean, there's some really good characters on the southern side. And so I had fun with that. And the second of the trilogy, Vicksburg, A Chain of Thunder, the story of Vicksburg takes place exactly at the same time as the story at Gettysburg, and it's virtually ignored in the East because all the reporters and the photographers are at Gettysburg.
Yeah.
It's the media, close to the media centers. Well, then I ran into a problem because the third of the trilogy was going to follow Sherman from Atlanta to the end in the Carolinas. And it's a great story that nobody really talks about. And I realize if I go from Vicksburg to Atlanta, I've just skipped a whole bunch of history.
Yes, you have.
So I convinced my publisher to let me do a fourth book and talk about Chattanooga, Lookout Mountain, following immediately after the Battle of Chickamauga. And again, the thread all the way through these four books is Sherman. I mean, he's the consistent character all the way through. And his evolution is a really interesting story. And, of course, by the time he gets to Georgia, and I was in Atlanta talking about this, and there are a lot of people there who really don't want to talk about Sherman.
No.
I found that out the hard way. But it's That's how it came about. I mean, I just wanted to tell a different story than most people are already familiar with.
So set the stage for us, for our listeners, for this particular book, The Smoke at Dawn.
Well, first of all, consider Vicksburg and Gettysburg, July of 1863, both enormous victories for the North. Well, finally, I mean, Abraham Lincoln is thrilled. There's a euphoria that goes through the North. Finally, we're winning the war. We've got some good people running the army. And then 2 months later in Chickamauga, at northern Georgia, in September of 1863, the North suffers a disastrous defeat. And so all that euphoria goes away. And Lincoln is really upset. He realizes he's got one man in the West that he can depend on, and that's Ulysses Grant. And he elevates Grant, he promotes Grant to command of the entire theater west of the Appalachian Mountains. The first thing Grant does, he goes to Chattanooga to try to salvage the mess there that has happened to the Union forces. He brings with him Sherman, who Grant feels is his best commander. He has George Thomas, who is a very overlooked character. He's the one bright spot at the Battle of Chickamauga. He gets the nickname, the Rock of Chickamauga. That's the northern side. On the southern side, on the Confederate Army there, under the command of Braxton Bragg. Braxton Bragg is probably the most disliked man during the entire Civil War. He's a terrible commander. He wins the Battle of Chickamauga, really no thanks to him. I mean, it's his subordinates who win it. And then he proceeds to besiege the Union Army in Chattanooga and does nothing. And he ends up waging war against his own subordinates. That's a story in itself. But you have one bright spot for the Confederacy, and this is another overlooked figure who I think is probably the finest battlefield commander of the Confederate Army and possibly of the Civil War, and that's Patrick Claiborne.
Yeah.
And Claiborne is a big part of the campaign around Chattanooga. His story, fighting against Sherman, his adversary, that's a big part of the story. It's a piece of the war that most people do not look at, and yet what happens at Chattanooga opens the door for what happens later for Sherman at Atlanta.
Yeah.
And without Chattanooga going the way it goes, and I'm purposely being vague here, I'm not giving away the story, but without Chattanooga, you would have had no Atlanta, and you would have had no March to the Sea, and the war might have had a very different outcome.
Yeah, it could well have. Braxton Bragg, you know, it's interesting to me. Here's a little aside. You know, we have Fort Bragg in the United States. It's our biggest fort. I think it's our largest military fort in the U.S., and it's named for Braxton Bragg, who was first you might call him an enemy general in some ways, and second, he was detested by the people that were under him.
Well, one of the things that people have asked
me, how did that happen?
Because you also have Fort Hood in Texas, named after John Bell Hood, who was obviously, you know, a Confederate general, and as well as Fort Lee, Fort Pickett, Fort A.P. Hill. I mean, these are all Confederate generals. But prior to the Civil War, they were Union officers. They were all in the United States Army, and that's why, and there are a couple of exceptions. Someone pointed out to me Fort Rucker, Alabama. I mean, Rucker apparently was never, I don't know this, but apparently was never in the Union Army, and another one actually is Fort Benning in Georgia. Benning is a Civil War Confederate commander in the Civil War who's never in the Union, never in the United States Army, but the rest of them across the board, they were all officers in the United States Army. At one time, they wore blue. And that's the justification for naming a military base after them.
Interesting. Patty in Madison, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. First of all, Jeff, thank you so much for your books. When my son was in seventh grade, he wrote his longest book report ever on gods and generals.
Nice. So, thank you.
And, you know, you can weave all these stories through so much, many times of history, and the way you did it, bringing those people to life, the generals to life, was an amazing thing, so thank you. And the second thing is, you know, we used your battlefield guide, just to plug it a little bit, and it was a great help to us, especially for the two kids in the back seat. So we appreciate that, too. But one other thing I was wondering, have you ever thought about doing a book on Custer? We went out to Little Bighorn this year. Well, we went to Yellowstone, and, of course, they wanted to stop at Little Bighorn, which I didn't really want to stop at Little Bighorn. I had no desire, really. But when we got there, talk about a great, well-run national battlefield. And the Ranger Talk we went to was amazing. So anybody that has a chance, Ranger Talks, you know, the Rangers have such a passion for the subject they're talking about, and the guy that we had was so eloquent and painted the story in such detail. And, you know, they're national treasures, our park rangers. So thank you, Jeff, and I'll take my call off the air.
All right. Oh, thanks
well,
a lot,
thank
Patty.
You. I will say the subject of Custer has come up and with my publisher. Here's the problem. If you think about Hollywood, up until about the mid-1960s, every Western you ever saw, who were the good guys? The United States Cavalry. Well, then, I mean, John Wayne, you know, Randolph Scott, you know, all these people. Okay, you get into the 70s and 80s, who are the bad guys? The United States Cavalry. And unfortunately, there's an issue of political correctness here, which I just despise. But my publisher is all nervous about. If I portray Custer as the good guy, and you know those bad old Indians as the bad guys, I'm going to get roasted because that's politically incorrect. However, if I go the other way, if I portray Sitting Bull and the Sioux as the good guys and the United States Cavalry as the bad guys, I'm going to get enormous backlash from people who don't really think that way. Another word that I'm saying is it's a no-win situation. And, yes, it's a great story, but my publisher, we're looking at several other topics, including Korea, including Vietnam, including the war for Texas independence. I have a pretty full plate. So, you know, maybe down the road a ways, but right now I don't like hornet's nests. I don't like stirring up politics and stuff. That's just not me at all. And unfortunately, any story about, you know, dealing with Native Americans and the U.S. Cavalry, it's very controversial these days. I just don't want to go there. And that's the reason why I haven't done it.
Jeff Shara, our guest today, author of many books about the Civil War. Also, he's written about World War I and II and the Revolutionary War. His latest book is The Smoke at Dawn, talking with him about this period in the Civil War. He's written a wonderful book, and I hope you'll join in. If you have questions or comments for him, maybe you've written or maybe you've read some of his other books, maybe you've read this book, give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. I'm Larry Mueller, Jason Butler, on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, talking with award-winning novelist Jeff Shara about his most recent Civil War book. It's called The Smoke at Dawn. And again, inviting you to join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. Jim and Rice Lake up next. Jim, hi. Thank you for calling.
I wanted to contribute an little-known fact about Custer, and that is during the critical battle of Gettysburg, people remember that Jeb Stuart forsake Lee, but before the end of the battle, Lee sent Stuart and some of his cavalry to try to flank the Union position at Cemetery Hill, and a then-unknown colonel commanding a regiment of Michigan cavalry stopped the enfilade, and that leader of that Michigan cavalry was Custer.
Yeah.
Oh yes, I mean there's a battlefield. They're actually restoring much of that. They call it the East Cavalry Field at Gettysburg. There were other people besides. Actually, a guy named Gregg was involved in that as well as Custer. But yeah, that was a victory for Union cavalry, and that might have saved a considerable embarrassment for the Union during and after Pickett's charge. And you're absolutely right. I mean, Custer does play a very valuable
valuable role. He even plays a role actually earlier than that. He serves several occasions. He rises quickly from lieutenant, and at the end of the war, after the war, to colonel by his actions in the field. No, he's definitely a good commander.
Yeah.
And people don't know that about him. All they know about is disastrous Union campaign. But had he not helped contribute, then Pickett's charge on Cemetery Hill would have been a different matter. And finally, I'm a native of Boston, and there's a wonderful statue to George Tecumseh Sherman in front of the Boston Public Library in Boston for those who admire Sherman creating what is now known as Total War.
Yeah.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling. I'm going to take some other calls as well. Just a Facebook post from Karen, who just said, if you go to Gettysburg, the local Boy Scout office offers a guidebook for 3 days of hikes to follow the 3 days of the battle. Our troop did it on the actual days of the battle in 2003, a very moving and exhausting experience.
I agree with that. And I mean, both. It is moving and it is exhausting. And if you do it in July, it's hot.
Yeah.
Which makes it authentic.
Yep. Connie in Genesee, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. I have a question about doing research. Would Petersburg be a good place to do some research? I have a third great uncle that was killed there, and we don't have a whole lot of information on him outside of the fact that we know he died there and was buried in a common grave. And my other question would be, why did widows and mothers not get compensation? It took his mother, who he was never married, it took his mother 15 to 20 years to get any kind of compensation for having died in the Civil War.
Well, let me ask you, was he North or South?
He was North.
Okay, because that's one easy answer right there. If he was Southern, there was very little compensation and very little information, and I'm not being facetious about that. The Southern records were mostly destroyed in Richmond. But, if you go to Petersburg, the National Battlefield there is a really – I mean, it's one of the places I mentioned in my Battlefield book. I mean, there are some specific places to go at Petersburg that are absolutely wonderful. There is an enormous Confederate cemetery there, by the way, just as an aside, there are very few of those. But you can certainly talk to the Park Service at Petersburg. They have a large visitor center there and some rangers there, historians there, who would be happy to help you out. And if there is something, they actually have software now that can identify if you know the name or even if you don't even know the unit, if you just know the state that your ancestor fought in, they can find him.
They don't know where because they were buried in common graves. Can't find a grave for him.
Well, it's like just like here at the National Cemetery at Gettysburg. I mean, there are hundreds and hundreds of dead whose graves are simply marked by a number. And that's the case in most national cemeteries. There's always that section where we just don't know. Unfortunately, and I wish I could give you a better answer, unfortunately, if, 150 years later, we don't have any better information on those unknown soldiers than we had then. And that's a really sad thing. And I don't really know what to tell you about that. The issue of the pensions, I mean, that was really Congress. I mean, once Congress sort of got around to it and they got enough pressure, I think a lot of people think about the Civil War. The the horror of those 4 years, a lot of people just wanted it to go away. And so the veterans, even the veterans themselves, they just didn't, everybody wanted it in the past. Lincoln's assassination, which capped it off, as horrible as that was, people wanted that behind them and wanted it forgotten. And so Congress, it took some motivation for Congress to finally approve some of the pension acts and approve some of the compensation for the widows, from the orphans. It took a while. And a lot of it also had to do, there were a couple of major financial crashes between the end of the Civil War and the turn of the century, where virtually like a small version of the Great Depression, where there wasn't the money to pay these people. So a lot of times it was after the 1900 before some of the widows and orphans actually got benefit money.
And it was almost, I think it was nearly 1890 when she finally did get a pension, but she had applied, and I found all of her applications in the archives at the national government, and they, all, every application that went through that she filed was just denied until they finally gave it to her.
Yeah. She was persistent, and eventually I don't know if paid off is the right way to say it, but it.
Well, the thing is, it's sort of like, you know, there are parallels today. Sometimes when you're dealing with the government, you have to have persistence.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Connie. John in Seneca, your turn. Hi, John.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Great. Appreciate your call.
My wife's great-grandfather was a Union soldier during the Battle of Chickamauga, and his group was part of what got cut off and was isolated and eventually captured. And apparently, to the left flank, there was a misalignment of the Union troops, opened up about a mile gap. Confederates just poured through that like water through a sieve, and that's what really helped the Confederates, was a big blunder by the Union troops. So he was wounded and captured, and as I understand it, reading the different histories, He was traded back, but some of those soldiers went to Andersonville, so I guess we're fortunate that he didn't go and he was wounded.
Well, yeah, you actually, it wasn't the Union soldiers that opened up that gap in the Union line. It was their commanding general, William Rosecrans, made a disastrous blunder, pulled an entire division out of line and moved it, not really knowing the disposition of his own troops. At the same time he did that, coincidentally, the Confederates launched an assault.
Longstreet, wasn't it?
The command of James Longstreet, and Longstreet marched his troops ahead, kept marching. They had suddenly realized they're right in the middle of what was supposed to be the Union position, and there was nobody there. And they kept going, and yes, that's exactly what happened. They divided the Union army in half, caused a panic in the Union, and that's what led to the retreat back to Chattanooga, which is where I begin this new book. I mean, it actually literally starts with that retreat. The subject of Andersonville, I mean, that book, by the way, is being re-released. The old McKinley Cantor, the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, is being re-released next spring. I mean, that is you talk about a dismal story, and how, you know, the inhumanity of man to man and an American to American, how that could have happened. I mean, it's a horrible story. You're very fortunate that your ancestor did not end up there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Your research, did you determine that troops were sent to Andersonville, the captured Union?
Oh, yes. I mean, there were several prisoner of war, you want to call them POW camps, in Georgia. Andersonville was only one of several. There was another one at Millen, Georgia, which is near Milledgeville, which was the state capital then. I'm actually dealing in my research with that right now, Sherman's March to the Sea. There were several of those. Andersonville, by far, though, is the most notorious.
Mm. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Just talking about a soldier, John just says, well, my wife's great-grandfather was a Union soldier. One of the things you write about is you write from the perspective of the very well-known figures like Grant or Sherman, but also from the viewpoint of the more everyday characters, so to speak, who would never make it into the history books under normal circumstances. And you certainly have a good example of that in this book.
Well, I did that all the way through this series, and the first three particularly. I realize, I mean, you know, to tell a story just from the top down, just from the points of view of the generals, that's not the best story. And you need to have that kid, the kid with the musket in his hands who's terrified out of his mind. He has to march across an open ground or up a hill into the guns of the enemy. He has to either kill or be killed. I mean, and that's very serious. What's that like? And so that became a big part of this series, not so much in the first series. That happened after I did the World War I and World War II books, when I realized you cannot just tell a story from the general's point of view. So, yes, that thread also winds all the way through this series, and to me, I'm very proud of that. I mean, I'm very pleased the way it turned out, and I hope it adds a perspective to the story that, you know, maybe most people just aren't used to.
Yeah, absolutely. I wonder if is it more challenging to write from that person's perspective?
Definitely, because the information, first of all, research is a little bit tougher to find, and I end up creating composite characters. Everything happened. Everything is real. It may not have all happened exactly to one person, but I have to do that, and that, you know, that's a little tougher than writing just from the point of view of somebody like Sherman or Bragg or Grant, to create that character and give him, you know, have him with a personality and have him with the experiences that the generals never have. And that does add something, I think. It adds something to the story.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Amanda wondered in an email, who's, by the way, 14 years old, if women fought in men's uniform, was that on both sides? How many,
yep.
Were there a lot, and how were they treated if they were found out?
Well, the how many part is something we'll never know, because a lot of them were never found out. I mean, there are some famous cases of women who went off with their husbands in some cases. Some women who were single just decided to fight, and they had to put on, they hid their gender. When they were wounded or killed is when they were discovered. And I mean, obviously, and that usually, if a woman was willing to take a bullet, she earned a measure of respect that it might surprise you. I mean, this was a time when women stayed home, but the women who didn't and who ended up paying a price for it, there was considerable respect paid to them. So, I mean, and by the way, there were a lot of female spies. A lot of women, they could hide things under their bloomers and get away with, you know, transporting papers and things like that that men never could have. And so they, served on both sides again and performed valuable service.
Well, Jeff, I really appreciate you taking time to be with us. I'm looking forward to your next book, and I hope we have a chance to talk about it when it comes out.
I hope so. Thank you.
Jeff Shara, our guest today, he is the author of The Smoke at Dawn. Great to talk with him about The Smoke at Dawn, and I hope you'll stay tuned, because after the news, we're going to be visiting with two Wisconsin Civil War reenactors and find out how they research and plan their events, including the big one coming up in just a couple of weeks.